So this morning, we're going to begin a small series that relates to three books. Today's book is The Prime Minister. It's this blue book by Yehuda Avner. Next week, we're going to have Kol Yom Rishon. We have a very special father and son tag team, Rabbi and Dr. Pelkovitz. And then the following week is going to be a book by Tal Ben Shachar. Tal Ben Shachar is, as you can imagine, is an Israeli. He's a positive psychology expert at Harvard. And he now goes around the country and the world. He goes around the world running seminars and getting paid significant amounts of money to present his ideas. And he's written several books. So I read a big chunk of one of his previous books, but just 3-4 weeks ago, he came out with a new book, which I'll send around the email again this week just to make sure everybody has the title if you're interested to find it in the library. And then the last book is going to be the newest book by the chief rabbi, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. So the reason for this is because, as many of you have been here before, on Sunday mornings we look for God in many different places. We're on a journey looking for God. And we find him in different countries and different topics. Sometimes it has to do with coffee, other times it has to do with, you know, all kinds of things. So I figured for this particular group of get-togethers, we should find God and be able to find the Torah that exists in many great books. I find each one of these, they're each very different in their own way, as we'll see. But there are many lessons to be gleaned from these books in terms of our own development as Ovdei Hashem. This book is not so popular today, but it still exists. It's called a dictionary. It's somewhat outmoded, but I still like it. So if I were to describe the Prime Ministers, which for those who haven't read it yet, it's a collection of vignettes. It's somewhere between historical fiction and autobiography and political narrative. It's a very interesting style of a book, authored by Yehuda Avner, who served in many different diplomatic posts as well as political roles for different prime ministers. So it's an inside look at what he calls here an intimate narrative of Israeli leadership. And he speaks specifically about Prime Ministers Levi Eshkol and Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, and most significantly, he speaks at length about the great Jewish leader, the great Yid, which is probably, I would say, if Menachem Begin were here today, he would probably want most to be known as the great Yid, which is what he was, a Menachem Begin. So if I were to describe this book in one word, I would say that it's inspirational. It's an inspiration. But that word, I think, needs a moment of definition, because many people, especially those of us who are involved in education, we like to use the word inspire. That's the word today in the realm of education. Our job in the kollel, in the school, in the shul is to inspire people. Did anybody ever actually sit down and think about what it means to inspire somebody? How do you measure if you inspired somebody? How do I know if I did my job? So if you look in the dictionary, according to the dictionary, the word inspiration means stimulation of the intellect or emotions to a high level. And the condition of being so stimulated. Then the second definition here, one that moves the intellect or emotions or prompts action. That's the definition of inspiration. What's the definition of inspire? It is to guide or affect by divine influence. I'm not a prophet. To fill with a high emotion, exalt, to stimulate to creativity or action. So I would define inspire, especially when we're talking about it in terms of Jewish education, in a related but maybe slightly different way. And that is that when you speak of inspiring, it actually has to do with enabling somebody to realize their potential. Why do I say that? Because what does it mean when the dictionary says to guide or affect by divine influence? Where does divine influence come from? So the truth is, divine influence come from up high. But Rav Kook writes in the introduction to the Siddur, divine influence, especially when it comes to davening, really comes from within. Because every person is a chelek elokam imal, has a divine spark within each of us. And deep down, it helps guide us and shape our life. What happens when we feel inspired is it's an aha moment where we realize, wow, we realize that we can accomplish more than we thought before. We realize just how significant the divine spark is within us. You know, we'll read something that'll make us realize that we can accomplish more. And realize is tarti mashma. One is the cognition, we understand, but also realize in terms of action, to make something real. And that's very much what I think about this book, especially about the life of Menachem Begin. I have not yet been to the new Begin Museum in Yerushalayim. I haven't spent enough time, unfortunately, to visit. But you read the stories about Menachem Begin, and I feel inspired. Why do I feel inspired? Why do I feel moved? Because I realize, here's Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin is just a regular Yid. He's just a plain, poshut person, like everybody sitting in this room. Just a plain, poshut person. And yet this man finds the fortitude and the vision and the courage to build a life that is almost superhuman. Now, obviously, he's blessed with oratory skills that the average person, me and you, were not blessed with. But at the same time, he's just off the charts. He's simply off your charts when you read about his life and what he accomplished and how he views the world, how he views Jewish life. And that's an inspiration because it says to me, you know what? There's something in me that could be also a shtickle Menachem Begin. There's something that I can realize in my life to be like that, to accomplish something like that. Now, I'm not going to be fighting in the underground. That's not my style, really. At least not now. Everybody's got to figure out where they lie on that continuum of Menachem Begin's accomplishments. But the notion that we look at something or someone, we go see, I don't know, the fireworks, and we feel wondrous about it. We realize how significant God is in the world, and we realize, wow, that there's a piece of God as a part of me. I have something to accomplish here. That's, I think, what inspiration is about. The whole journey of Torah is to some degree, to inspire us, to make us realize how significant we are, what our chelek elokai is, what we can accomplish, every person in their own way. And that's what I think, to me, was the most amazing about this story, that you take a regular one man, a European boy, and you can accomplish amazing things. Different people in different set of circumstances. So that's, I think, my most fundamental personal takeaway from this story. There are many observations, many stories. It's like, this is like 100 rabbi sermons and 1,000 shiurim in this book about the different ideas that are going to appear here. But I wanted to focus on three, because I think three of them, we can relate them very much to our life. There are also some very humorous stories, which we enjoy very much also. The Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, and I brought several books, because once we're talking about books, I brought a few other ones to discuss, because they're recommended reading for people who like these things. So, the Shulchan Aruch, in the beginning of Yoredeya, which is the section about mitzvos that relate to Isser and Heter, like keeping kosher and mezuzah and mourning laws of Avelos, and the family purity laws, all those appear in Yoredeya. In the beginning, it talks about the laws of slaughter. And we know that there are specific qualifications for people who are shochtim. And the Gemara has a principle, which is codified in Shulchan Aruch, that if a person is a mechalal Shabbos, they are dino ka'akum. If a person is a mechalal Shabbos, which today it's probably very difficult to find somebody who we would categorize as a mechalal Shabbos, what we call bifarhesia. Mechalal Shabbos bifarhesia means they desecrate Shabbos brazenly, wantonly, and deliberately. So it's very hard to come by today, unfortunately, because of the way that the society is such. That's probably been, according to the Binyan Zion and many other poskim, already 150, 200 years, it's hard to find somebody who deliberately, brazenly was brought up embracing Shabbos and then rebelled and revolted and decided that Shabbos is not for them. Most people today, unfortunately, they were never educated about Shabbos. They never really got into Shabbos in the first place. So they don't know. They don't know. It's a whole different halachic story. But somebody, let's say, maybe there's one person out there. I don't know. I've never probably
not. There's a whole book about this woman, this this Hasidic woman who did that.
So maybe this one person in the whole world was a Mechal Shabbos. Very uncommon halachically to be considered a Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia. Very uncommon. I don't think I've ever met such a person in my life. I've met many, unfortunately, not observant Jews, but I don't think I've ever met, not that I can recall, a Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia. So such a person, if you were to meet one, the Shulchan Aruch says they have the halachic status when it comes to shechting as a non-Jewish person. That means that if they shechted an animal, it would not be kosher. And it means that they cannot be counted toward a minyan. And a whole host of other halachic consequences. This is one of the... It's probably the stiffest description in halacha about anybody. The only equivalent description is what we call a Oved Avodah Zarah, an idol worshiper. So that's pretty serious stuff. It's this interesting observation that Shabbos, a person who's a Shabbos desecrator, again, in a specific context, in Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia, they're like a goy. Not only that, if you think about, the Torah has, unfortunately, many different punishments that could be potentially meted out in the old days when Bezdin, when the rabbinic court was in its... in its full authority, there are many different punishments that could be meted out. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin has a debate about which is the most stringent, which is the worst, the absolute worst punishment. So the Gemara seems to machlokes tanan, we seem to conclude in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin that the worst punishment is skila, stoning. Stoning is the very unpleasant process of pushing somebody off of a building and then pelting them with stones and then taking a giant boulder and making sure that the job is finished unless they get away. So it's a long discussion, the Gemara and Sanhedrin. It's a very unpleasant story. It's very rare. Mrs. Geller, you're not into that?
No.
It didn't happen very often. Okay. But the concept is out there. The concept is out there. So we need to learn something from that concept, and obviously, based on the significance and the severity of the punishment, you understand how severe the crime is. The punishment has to fit the crime. So if a person violates, we talk about this on Yom Kippur, we just had this a few weeks ago, in the end of the Al Chait, so we go and we have different gradations of different things that we did, intentionally, inadvertently, related to different punishments at the end of the Al Chait. So, skila is the most severe punishment. And there are many capital crimes where there are four categories. There's skila, which is the most severe. Then there's sreifa, hereg, and chenek. Again, there's a dispute about exactly which is more stringent than the other, but that's not the point right now. If a person murders someone else, they don't receive the ultimate capital punishment. They only receive hereg. They're beheaded. But they don't get skila. Who gets skila? Only a select few people. Specifically, the Mechal Shabbos. If a person is a Shabbos desecrator, they would receive the punishment of Skila. It's like, whew, you ever think about that? Why is that? Why is it so serious that it's then every other capital crime, they don't get Skila? Even idol worshippers usually don't get Skila. It depends on the circumstance. Such a serious Aveira? It's like hard to believe. It's one general observation that the punishment, the consequences of not observing Shabbos are very severe. The other observation I would make about Shabbos, and Shabbos is our first topic, is that Shabbos doesn't have any mitzvahs. You ever think about that? On Pesach you eat matzah, on Sukkot you sit in the sukkah. Shavuos and Shemini Atzeres probably don't have many mitzvahs because they are parallel. They're called Atzeres. Atzeres means you just stop, but it relates to the fact that But Shabbos has no mitzvahs, no positive mitzvahs. We have restrictions that make sure that we keep a fence around the space, safe space of Shabbos, but we have mitzvahs called Zohar, right? What are the mitzvahs of Zohar? Zohar Yom HaShabbos L'Kadosho, which means Kiddush. Well, the truth is that, interestingly enough, Kiddush is not necessarily a mitzvah that's even done on Shabbos. The Rambam's opinion is, in Hilchos Shabbos, that you actually say Kiddush before Shabbos. Why? Because it's like a herald. It says, Shabbos is about to arrive. And the Rambam's opinion is that the other end, Havdalah, is a bookend. So, and this is the way we practice today. We don't say Havdalah on Shabbos, obviously not. Havdalah we say on Motzoi Shabbos. So the Rambam actually used to say not just Havdalah on Motzoi Shabbos, the Rambam seems to say that you say Kiddush on Friday afternoon, just before Shabbos, a little different than we do. Not that you can't do it, but it sounds like for the Rambam, you say Kiddush before Shabbos, Havdalah right after Shabbos. So we have bookended the Shabbos experience. Zachreu, Zechiras, Shevach, V'Kiddush. That's what the Rambam says. We demarcate this time with praise and sanctification. But on Shabbos, absent the Kiddush, there are no specific mitzvahs. It's very interesting. And finally, the Gemara says in Shabbos that Moshe Rabbeinu has to tell us, God says, you got to go tell the people, Matana achas yesh li beveis ganazai. I have a gift for you. And it's called Shabbos. Why is Shabbos called a gift? So we have Shabbos every week, but we don't take the time to think about it. So I ask you to open your white pages and listen to this speech. As we read together selections from the speech that Menachem Begin gave in the Knesset. The little A actually got cut off. This, each of the stories has a little letter in the corner. A, B, and C. And they correlate to the papers. Otherwise, I felt like color coordinating would make it easier. The first piece, which is about Shabbos, is going to be related to the pink paper, which says A on it. Mr. Speaker, ladies and gentlemen, so just right now on the white pages. Members of the Knesset, Begin began. The government has decided that following a time lapse of 3 months, the aircraft of our national airline, El Al, will no longer fly on the Jewish Sabbath and festivals. Now, I'm going to only read the pieces that I bracketed. You can read the rest on your own. 40 years ago, I returned from exile to Eretz Yisrael. Engraved in my memory still are the lives of millions of Jews, simple, ordinary folk, eking out a livelihood in that forlorn diaspora where the storms of anti-Semitism raged. They were not permitted to work on the Christian day of rest, Sunday, and they refused to work on their day of rest, Saturday, for they lived by the commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So each week, they forswore 2 whole days of hard-won earnings. This meant destitution for many, but they would not desecrate the holy Shabbos day. Adroitly cutting through the pandemonium, Begin told the tale of Salonika as he did, and as he did so, the house listened. In Greece, there is a port city called Salonika, which had an extensive Jewish population before the war. Most of the port workers there were Jewish, and on Shabbos, they did not work. Those stevedores would forego their pay rather than desecrate the Shabbos. The Goyim accepted this as a fact of life, and the port was closed on the Shabbos day. Imagine that. Turn the page. With arms held high, he thundered, one nation alone sanctified the Shabbos. Editorial notes here, Reuven Brand. I literally get chills when I read this piece. It's unbelievable. A small nation, the nation that heard the voice at Sinai, so that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you. Ours is the nation that bequeathed to humanity the imperative of a day of rest to apply to the most humble of beings. Ours is the nation that gave the laborers the dignity equal to that of their employers, that both are equal in the eyes of God. Ours is the nation that bequeathed this gift to other faiths, Christianity, Sunday, Islam, Friday. Ours is the nation that enthroned Shabbat as sovereign queen. A chorus of approval from the government benches went up, muffling every last vestige of dissent. Begin, idol of the common folk, caught up in his enthusiasm and sense of mission, rose to a crescendo. So are we in our new and our reborn Jewish state to allow our blue and white El Al planes to fly to and fro as if to broadcast to the world that there is no Shabbos in Israel? Should we, who by faith and tradition heard the commandment at Sinai, now deliver a message to all and sundry through our El Al planes? No, do not remember the Shabbos day. Forget the Shabbos day. Desecrate the Shabbos day. I shudder at the thought that the aircraft of our national carrier have been taking off the world over on the seventh day over the many years in full view of Jews and Gentiles alike. Skipping. There is no way of assessing the religious, national, social, historical, and ethical values of the Shabbos day by the yardstick of financial loss or gain. In our revived Jewish state, we simply cannot engage in such calculations. If it were not for the Shabbos that restored the souls and revived the spiritual lives week by week of our long-suffering nations, our nation, our trials and vicissitudes would have pulled us down to the lowest levels of materialism and moral and intellectual decay. And to hammer this point home, he ended his speech with the celebrated saying, editorial note, I believe this was Achar Ha'am, more than the Jews have kept the Sabbath day has kept the Jews.
Excuse me for interrupting. The parking lot over there is needed for setup for Noah's Ark, so anyone's parked there needs to move within the next 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. With that, he turned to limp back to his seat. Amid cheers and jeers, but hardly had he taken a step when struck by a sudden additional thought, just one further point. We won't go too far. The House should know. I'm sorry. He hobbled back to the microphone and declared, Mr. Speaker, allow me just one further point. This House should know it is not necessary. Thank you. Someone's going to move it for me whenever they... Thank you. Thank you very much. It is not necessary to be an observant Jew, this is unbelievable, to appreciate the full, historic, and sacred aura that enshrines this perfect gift called Shabbos. Its prohibitions are not arbitrary. They provide insulation against corrosive everydayness. They build fences against invasions by the profane. And they enrich the soul by creating a space for sacred time. In a word, one need not be pious to accept the cherished principle of Shabbos. One merely needs to be a proud Jew. Pilei Floyd. So when I read this, my mind sent me to a book called Shabbos Malkasa. It's the one you have on the pink sheet. The book Shabbos Malkasa was authored by Rav Shimshon Pinkus, gift to me by my brother. Rav Shimshon Pinkus died in a terrible auto accident in Israel, and since his passing, many books have been published of his teaching posthumously. But this was actually one of the few volumes that he authored in his lifetime. And here he speaks a whole book just about Shabbos. So you'll see that the letters marked A1 and A2 for side 1. Go to side 1 for a second. Now we understand. Based on Menachem Begin, he says, Ikar ha-mitzvah ha-miyuchedes l'Shabbos. The main thing about Shabbos, Hio Emuna, is the faith. But faith, as we've said before, is not an accurate translation. Emuna doesn't mean intellectual faith. Emuna comes from the concept of aim, of feeling the presence of God. Vahainu Zachor Es Yom HaShabbos. Remember Shabbos. What are you remembering? You're supposed to be thinking. What are we thinking? Lizkor, to remember. V'lasim Lev, and to pay attention. El Metzias HaShabbos, to the reality of Shabbos. Ve'el ma shehi melamedes osanu. What does it teach us? HaShabbos Atzma. Shabbos itself. Leis la migarma klum. It has nothing. It has no mitzvos. In a certain sense, Rabbi Engel spoke about this in one of his drushes on Sukkos. Not Rabbi Engel. When I was in Baltimore, the rabbi in the shul there. Mitzvahs could potentially even be a distraction, in a sense that if you get caught up in doing a particular thing, maybe you'll lose the big picture. So therefore on Shabbos, there are no mitzvahs, because it's all about remembering the big picture. HaShabbos, what's that? Ein lo tochen o mitzvah avoda. There's no practical item that you do. Rak shederach HaShabbos, through Shabbos. Shabbos is a portal. Romes Hashem Yisbarach v'yikhudo. It's a way to remind us, to make us mindful of the creation of the world. Turn the page over. And that's why... go to the bottom of the right-hand column where it says the first paragraph is V'loma. V'loma Shabbos, Shona Shabbos, Bezeh Mikulam. Why is Shabbos different? To Kol HaKadushos, General Holiness, Hein Echos Shel Kedusha Kol Achas Kafima Alasa Ukedei Le'eskar Av LaHashem. Generally, sanctity is about us climbing the ladder to God. Avol Shabbos, he kedusha Hashem yizbarach atzma kaviyachol. It's actually the sense of godliness coming into our lives. So now we understand why Menachem Begin, in his little way, recognized that Shabbos is a matana. He called it the perfect gift. That's why the Gemara says he told Moshe, go tell the Jewish people. But it's interesting that the Gemara says he had to tell us that it's a gift. Because otherwise we would just walk through it in some pedestrian manner. Which is unfortunately a big challenge. It's a challenge. But the idea that Shabbos doesn't have any mitzvahs is because this idea, it's a bigger idea than a specific thing. And now perhaps I can understand why the concept of Mumar L'chal Shabbos B'farhesia Dino Ka'akum. Because Shabbos is actually the entirety of the Jewish religion distilled into one entity. It's not just one specific practice that relates to one aspect. It's the entirety of Jewish experience. I don't say belief, because again, emunah doesn't mean belief. It's not like some list of items that you either check or don't check. Emunah is an experience, a feeling. So now I understand. Shabbos is, at its core, the most central observance of all the observances that we have. And therefore, Menachem Begin is touching on something so deep. And therefore, even if you're not observant, even if you don't get this particular mitzvah, you don't do that particular mitzvah, it has nothing to do with it. Because Shabbos comes back to the fact that God created the world and He's got a mission for the world. It's the most basic and fundamental definition of a Jew, that we are the people of God and that the world is a place for God. That's what we do every single Shabbos. And that is, I think, a really important lesson that we can reflect on as we think about Shabbos. Yes?
What about the three meals we have to have on Shabbos? Is that a mitzvah?
So there are probably a whole handful of mitzvahs midrabanan. There are rabbinic mitzvahs that we do that help us, because the rabbis understood that if we don't have a little bit of structure, then we're going to be lost. So therefore, the Ramban says that we learn from Mikra Kodesh that we got to go to shul. We have to have Torah reading. We have to have three meals. But all those are like a rabbinic skeleton for what the day is really about. You know, you can have three meals, but your meals on Shabbos could be like your meals on Tuesday. That's why the Allah says no. That's why we also know there's a din. Again, it's a din d'rabbanan, because it's not the core. The core of the day is nothing. The core of the day is just focus. It's just a mental state. You have Shabbos clothes, right? V'chibarot, you have to have special Shabbos clothes. You have to speak differently on Shabbos. You have to walk differently to shul on Shabbos. All these things. Well, to shul, you can run to shul on Shabbos, but you shouldn't be running like to the park or something. We only run to shul. But on Shabbos, we don't run. Everything on Shabbos is different. But it's all to bring us back to the same point. And those are all institutions, either midivrei neviim or midirabbanon. But they're not, you look in the Chumash, it just says, Zochus Yom HaShabbos HaKadosh. Remember, you got to just pay attention to what this day is. So later in the book, you'll find, they describe how Menachem Begin, he used to spend Shabbos reading. He used to spend Shabbos reflecting. Again, you don't have to be an observant person. It happens to be that my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, my father's father, he was a very active religious Zionist. And then after a very interesting life, which is not, I don't have time, it's not the venue to talk about now. So they made Aliyah, my grandparents. My grandfather now is in the Olam HaEmes. But they lived, my grandmother still lives, she should live and be well. She lives in Kiryat Moshe. And Menachem Begin lived in Beit HaKerem. And my grandfather had a best friend. His best friend in the whole world was a rabbi and a distinguished professor, a great gaon. His name was Dr. Meyer Hershkowitz. Dr. Hershkowitz was a Tanakh professor at YU until the 70s when he made Aliyah. And they lived around the street corner from each other. And Mrs. Hershkowitz still goes to visit my grandmother. They spend Shabbos, came out every week. And they schmooze and have tea or whatever. They drink Shabbos morning together. So Dr. Hershkowitz was invited. He used to be on a special rotation that Saturday night in Menachem Begin's house, they had a Chumash class. So Dr. Hershkowitz used to give the class very often. And my grandfather used to go to the shir. So when my grandfather passed away, my grandmother took a lot of my grandfather's artifacts, because he had a very interesting life, and he was very active in different things, and she donated it to Religious Zionist Archives in Yerushalayim. So I went there, and among the many different items that were there, included in that were Mar Makomel sheets from the Saturday Night Shiur in Menachem Begin's house. Menachem Begin was such a yid, and he didn't have any shame to get up in front of people, even people who derided him, and tell them that we are proud Jews, this is how we have to be. That's observation number one. Observation number two comes from this unbelievable speech that Begin gave. Let's go to B. Avner describes how how we went to listen to Begin speak. Section B. It's on page C, actually, in the white page. It's the next page. The white page, it's the bracket is on the bottom. And Begin is speaking now, the beginning of the paragraph started with the word lowering. He's speaking now. It's going to be page 78 on the bottom. Yud Avner is listening to speak about the story of the Altalena. Now, the Altalena was one of the darkest, most tragic periods of the creation of the State of Israel and this terrible infighting that existed at the time. And the tragedy of Jews trying to smuggle arms and other Jews to Israel. Another group of Jews shelling the ship, which went down in flames. So it was a terrible tragedy. Listen to how Begin, who was on that ship, who had to be dragged off of the ship, reflects on it. Lowering his voice almost to a whisper, he led us deep into the beleaguered world of his Irgun underground, to shine a light on that black hole of 1944. It was a year of unspeakable torment, he said forlornly. Our sisters and brothers in Europe were being slaughtered in the millions. Ben-Gurion insisted we join the Allies in defeating the Nazis before rebelling to expel the British from our land. My colleagues and I thought otherwise. Ben-Gurion was so hostile to our revolt, he tried to quash it by unleashing his Haganah men to round up our fighters and hand them over to the British. It was madness. It was tearing Jews apart. I could smell the stench of civil war. Here, he paused, his voice quivering slightly as he caressed his next words. So I told our men to go quietly, not to resist. It was extremely hard to order our men to restrain their natural instinct for revenge. But I had to do it. I had to do it. Ki Yehudim anachnu. Skipping. His voice caught again, but he turned into a slight cough, a throat clearing, and in velvet words he went on. All the love of which the human heart is capable wells up within me as I recall our underground fighters, unflinching, fearless, moved by a supreme fighting spirit, and who nevertheless allowed themselves to be flung into detention camps, thrown into dark cellars, starved, beaten, and maligned. And not one of them, he rose to his full height, his eyes fierce with pain, not one of them broke his solemn oath not to retaliate. From the depths of Jewish history came the order not to fight back, and it was obeyed to the very last man. He trumpeted this with a stab of the finger, his face as granite as his eyes, and the audience responded with another mighty wave of applause. But then a sudden rigidity came over him, and his shoulders lifted in the manner of a soldier at a march. Now hear this, each and every one of you, and hear it well. I live by an iron rule. A Jew must never lift a finger against another Jew. Never! A Jew must never shed the blood of another Jew. Never! 20 centuries ago, we faced the bitter experience of the destruction of our separate Second Temple, the destruction of our capital, Jerusalem. And why? Because of our senseless hatred of each other. A hatred that led to civil war and to our utter ruin. Bechiyah ledorot, generations of tears. And therefore, I long ago took a solemn oath that no matter the provocation, no matter the circumstances, I would never be party to a civil war. Never! He was standing ramrod straight, his face fearless, his hands bald, his voice choking with sincerity. Do we know from history what a civil war does to a nation? Do we not know that the generations pass before a nation at war with itself? The generations pass before a nation at war with itself can ever heal. Therefore, I say to you tonight, a curse on him who preaches civil war. Let his hand be cut off before he raises it against another Jew. There will never be a civil war in Israel. Never. What a powerful teaching. And he relates this story in a different context when he's speaking to a reporter in the Waldorf Astoria. It's another part of the book. But it's the same concept, another very important lesson from Menachem Begin. And it's unfortunately a lesson that he eludes the fact that we pay for this lesson. There is an interesting book. It's a 5-volume set. It's called Nesiv Bina. It's from Rav Yisachar Yaakovson. It's all about the Nusach HaTfila, about different aspects of davening, what the origin of it is, where it comes from. And so he has one book on davening during the week, another book on Shabbos, another book on the festivals. This one relates to special days like Chanukah, Bris Milah, benching, and then he has about the fast days. So there's a whole section here about the liturgy for fast days. We would call them kinos, or slichos. So he refers to one specific one that's probably known to everybody in this room, and that is the story of the Asara Haruge Malchus, the story of the 10 martyrs. The 10 martyrs, that story appears not in the Talmud, in later Midrashim. So I actually Xeroxed for you both pages, for those who are interested in the scholar discussion. It's in the off-white, brownish sheet. It's on side one, he tells you the story of the Kina of the Asar Haruge Malchus. This is a scholarly work, Rav Yaakov's in the Nesiv Bina. So he talks about the different Midrashim. We refer to these 10 martyrs twice, once on Tisha B'Av, in the Kina called Arzei Levanon, and then on Yom Kippur, at the end of the service of the Avoda, we have a parak called Ela Ezkera. It's the same theme, different emphasis, different purpose, different function, but he has a long discussion about this. So he cites four different traditions of exactly the Nusach, so he gives you all the different the manuscripts of where they come from, and then at the end he gives you probably the most complete description of this Medrash Asar Haruge Malchus, which begins at the bottom of B1. Let's just turn it over to B2. Pamachas hayoshev v'osik b'Torah. One time, the Roman Caesar, on the top right-hand column of B2, on the brown page, umatzan, he found, what does it say in the Chumash? V'gonev ishu mecharo. If you steal a man and you sell him, mos yumas, he will surely die. V'holach, v'toch habayis kulo b'na'olim, v'dovkom b'ksalim. He filled the room with shoes, full of shoes, glued them to the wall. 2 lines later, after the parentheses, v'sholach achar Reb Shimon ben Gamliel. He sent to the patriarch of the Jewish community, Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, v'chaverov, and his friends, v'amalim, he said to them, Misha gonav ish mi b'nei Yisrael. Someone who steals a Jew, kidnaps him. V'holachu mechoro, and he went and he sold him. Madino, what's his punishment? Amrlo, the rabbi said to him, chayav misa. He has the capital punishment. Amalem, he said to them, imkein, atem chayav misa. You are liable for death. Kablo alatzmechem din shamayim. Accept upon yourself the commandment of heaven. Amrlo, they said to him, lama, why? Amalem, bishvil ache Yosef. For the brothers of Joseph, Shemachu es Yosef, as it says, Dichsiv Vayimkuru es Yosef. They sold Yosef. Uksiv, what does it say, a pasuk in the book of Amos? Uksiv al Michram Bakesef Tzadik Ve'evyon Ba'avur Na'alayim. This Roman Caesar was a shtickel alamdan, because he knew that the verse in Amos, according to rabbinic tradition, who were they selling? Evyon, who was the pauper? Ba'avur Na'alayim. He says, look around, fellas. What do you see here? V'lachain, toch also Rosh HaSabayis b'menolim k'deshi yakiru be'ezer dover machuas Yosef. They should know what the brothers sold Yosef for. Shenemar ba'avur na'alayim b'demei na'alayim. And then the Medrash goes on to describe what happened. That they threw him in the pit, and they stripped him of his clothing, and then they pulled him out and sold him to the Yishma'elim. And then the Medrash describes that miraculously he had a cloth that grew for him, but they had to add something because now they were selling to the Yishma'elim this boy Yosef, but now he had a coat, so they had to pay him for the coat. So they gave the brothers of Yosef, they gave him shoes. That's the Medrash. Now, did this story happen historically exactly as it's described here in this Medrash? I don't know. I wasn't there. But generally, when we learn Midrashim, that's not the point. Medrash is not a history book. That's not the point. Anybody who thinks that every time the rabbis make a statement about a teaching, and I had a whole discussion with a group of students, a group of freshman girls in the academy about this on Friday, that they're obviously, unfortunately, very shallow. That's not what the rabbis are doing generally when they learn Medrash. They're not trying to teach you pshat. They're not trying to teach you historically what happened. That's not what's interesting to them. What's interesting to us is to find meaning in the world. So they look at the story and they're going to describe it in this way. How long ago did this story happen? According to this Medrash, so this probably happened somewhere in the first century or early second century, because these 10 sages, and again, even the 10 sages, there's a dispute. Who were exactly the 10 sages? There seemed to be some discrepancy. They were killed over a period of years. So this is how many years after the Mechira of Yosef. What's the Medrash trying to tell us? It's probably telling us many things, but one is that the impact of the Mechiras Yosef and the civil war that began then wasn't finished yet. Remember, where are we talking now? We're talking just had hit us in the head, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. What was the Gemara saying, Yuma? Why was the second Beis HaMikdash destroyed? Sinas Chinam. You ever think about the fact that this feud, unfortunately, it's not clear, Rabbi David Foreman has a whole discussion about this. Did the brothers ever reconcile with Yosef? Not so clear. But when the kingdom is going to split, where's it going to split? Who's going to stay in the south? The kingdom of Yehuda. And who's going to go to the north? The kingdom of Yosef. So the divide between what we would call Rachel's children and Leah's children keeps playing itself out. So we have this Medrash of Asara Rugi Malchus. We have the story of the sale of Yosef, which, by the way, ends us up where? In Mitzrayim. The whole reason we get down to Mitzrayim, and this is, some of us have talked before about why Yosef is such an important part of the Seder. The dipping, Rabbeinu Manoach, why you dip, because it reminds us of that they dipped in the blood, and that maybe the sheep reminds us of the sheep, the Kedi Izim. A whole story, putting the blood on the doorpost and the blood that involved when they dipped the thing in the blood, the coat. Pasim, like Karpas, you know, a lot of discussion about that. Why? Because when we're thinking about Geula, we're thinking about healing the rift. And this is such a strong warning, because we need it. It's hard. It's hard to get along. Sometimes as families, it's very hard to get along. Especially in families, it's easy. It's easy to fall into a trap of fighting, machlokas. But this is such a powerful lesson from someone who could have so easily raised his hand and legitimately said it's self-defense. He himself, you know, describes in the beginning of the book how he was spending 3 days living in a hole in the wall without any food or water because he was being hunted down by the British, and half the Jews in the land would have turned him in. And yet, it's a red line. We need to learn that red line. It's another important lesson.
The Kanoim burned the storehouses in Yerushalayim.
Yeah, the Biryonim. That's exactly what the Gemara says in Gittin. So there's the second line that's very important to keep in mind. We have to be very, very careful. We might disagree. We're going to disagree. There are different viewpoints. But with the way in which we disagree, the type of language that we use, and the way that we use that language, we have to be careful. It's good to always have a check-in. That's another lesson. And the final lesson I want to share today obviously comes back to Eretz Yisrael. And I love this story. This is a great story. Last piece, and then you'll take out the green paper. So this is a discussion about a man, National Secretary Advisor. He was for Carter. Now, if someone could pronounce this name. And what was his first name? Could you please? Alright, whatever that is, that's what it is.
You're showing your act.
Exactly. Zbigniew. Zbigniew. What? New.
Polish.
Shine. Okay. His grandchildren now, their name is probably Brown.
Or Brennan.
So he was the national security advisor to Carter. So this is the description of Menachem Begin visiting Washington when he met with Carter. So at the end, this is what really struck me. The story goes, a discussion then ensued about the wording of the joint U.S.-Israeli statement to be issued later in the day at the conclusion of the Washington talks. The national security advisor had brought with him a draft for the prime minister's approval. And after analyzing each phrase with his eagle eye, Begin said, "Totally acceptable, but for two sentences." "And what are they?" he responded. "Please delete. The United States affirms Israel's inherent right to exist." "Why so?" "Because the United States' affirmation of Israel's right to exist is not a favor, nor is it a negotiable concession. I shall not negotiate my existence with anybody, and I need nobody's affirmation of it." Brzezinski's expression was one of surprise. "But to the best of my knowledge, every Israeli prime minister has asked for such a pledge." "I sincerely appreciate the president's sentiment," said Begin, "but our Hebrew Bible made that pledge and established our right over our land millennia ago. Never, throughout the centuries, did we ever abandon or forfeit that right. Therefore, it would be incompatible with my responsibilities as prime minister of Israel were I not to ask you to erase this sentence." And then, without pause, "Please delete, too, the language regarding the U.S. commitment to Israel's survival." "And in what sense do you find that objectionable?" "In the sense that we, the Jewish people alone, are responsible for our country's survival, no one else." Wordlessly and seemingly perplexed, the National Security Advisor deleted the offensive sentences, upon which the Prime Minister expressed himself totally satisfied. The Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga, the Gemara says that God cries every day. You know one of the things that God cries about, the Gemara says? Al ga'avasan shel Yisrael shenitla mehem. That because of the exile, what has been taken from us is the ga'avasan shel Yisrael, the pride of the Jewish people. That through centuries of being beaten and expelled and persecuted, so we walk around and we hold our heads in the international community. So Begin says, "Chevra, we need to pick ourselves up. We are the people of the Ribono Shel Olam, and this is our land. And we don't need to beg. We're not mendicants. We don't need to ask somebody else to tell us that this is our place." And you know what? Sometimes we need a reminder of that. Because that's part of the tragedy of Golus, that we've lost our pride, our national Jewish pride. And where does that come from? It comes from one place. It comes from the Torah. That's what Begin says. That's what he has no problem to tell even this non-Jewish Polish national security advisor. If you go back to the first Zionist conference, there was a great Rav who lived in Europe, who at that point was very elderly and therefore too infirm to travel. But his name was Rav Shmuel Moliver. Shmuel Moliver was a great one of the founders of the religious Zionist movement. And he was very active in the nascent return to Zion movement that was taking hold in primarily in Eastern Europe at the time. So he wasn't there, but he sent a letter. He sent his what he would have said to the conference. So this is found in a collection of essays. You can get this very easily. It's called The Zionist Idea. It's edited by Arthur Hertzberg. So this was 1897, his message to the first Zionist Congress. And what does he have? This is on C1. He makes several points. He says, keep in mind, "All sons of Zion must be completely convinced and must believe with perfect faith that the resettlement of our country, i.e., the purchase of land and the building of houses, the planting of orchards and the cultivation of the soil, is one of the fundamental commandments of our Torah. Some of our ancient sages even say that it is equivalent to the whole Torah, for it is the foundation of the existence of our people. A true lover of Zion is a man who believes this with all his heart and soul. Whoever assists us and does not hold this faith is comparable to one who contributes to a cause in which he does not really believe. The basis of Chibat Zion is the Torah, as it has been handed down to us from generation to generation, with neither supplement nor subtraction. I do not intend this statement as an admonition to any individual regarding his conduct, for as our sages have said, verily, there are none in this generation fit to admonish. I am nevertheless stating in a general way that the Torah, which is the source of our life, must be the foundation of our regeneration in the land of our forefathers. And this explains, at first glance, a very perplexing Rashi, which is on the back page, on the back of the green page. First Rashi in Chumash. Rashi says, Bereshis, the first one, right off the bat, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. Amar Ab Yitzchak, may have been his father. Lo hayatzarech la'askel es ha-Torah ela me'achodesh ha-zelachem. The Torah did not need to begin until Parashas Bo with the first commandment of Achodesh HaZelachem, Shi Mitzvah Rishonah, and Stava Ba Yisrael. That's the first commandment. Now, obviously, we know that the Torah is not just a book of commandments. We spoke about that last week. But that's the question. Umatam Pasach BeBereishis. So why did the Chumash begin with Bereishis? So he quotes a Pasach in Tehillim. Mishum, because Koach Masov Higid La'amo Lases Lohem Nachalas Goyim. The strength of his actions, he spoke to his people to give them the inheritance of nations. She'im yomru umos ha'olam. If the nations of the world will say, Li Yisrael, to the Jewish people, Listim atem, you're thieves. She'kavashtem arzos shivagoyim, that you have conquered the seven Canaanite lands. Heim omrim lahem. The Jewish people will respond, Kol ha'aretz shalakadosh baruch hu. All the land, all the earth belongs to God. Hu bra'a, he created it. Unesana la'asher yashar be'inav. He gave it to whom he saw fit. Biritzono nesana lahem. Initially he gave it to the seven Canaanite nations. Ubiritzono, willingly, nitala mehem unesana lanu. He took it from them and he gave it to us. Where does Rashi get this from? A medrash. So here's my question. What's going to happen? We're going to go to the United Nations and they're going to say, you guys are thieves. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to say, you didn't read the first Rashi. So I don't think that's the pshat of Rashi. I don't think that's what Rashi is saying at all. I think we need the self-confidence. Of course the Goyim aren't going to believe us if we tell them that Rashi says, that the Chumash says, it's that at a certain point, maybe we start to question ourselves. But we start to lose our Jewish pride and our confidence that this is Taka, our land. Maybe after people telling us, after so many and so many and so many years, we're thieves, maybe we would be lulled into the fact that we believe them. And sometimes when you listen to things that are said out there, unfortunately, there are Jewish people who sometimes are lulled into that fallacy. So the first Rashi in the Torah tells us, Chevra, if they tell us we're thieves, just remember we're not thieves. We're not thieves. We don't need to come to the government of the United States of America to ask them permission to have the state of Israel. We got that from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's the Gaava Sanchal Yisrael. It's the national Jewish pride that we need to have for ourselves. And not only do we need to have it for ourselves, we need to be confident in ourselves enough to say it to somebody else. To look the American government in the eye, and you have the description of how he describes what happens in Begin's meeting with Carter, and say, look, this is our land. We're going to have respect for other people. We're going to treat them nicely. We're going to figure out how to exist peacefully with our neighbors if they'll let us, for crying out loud. But this is our land. We have to have the confidence and the belief in the Torah, because if you don't have the Torah, so then there's this moral equivalency that'll enter into the equation. But when you have the Torah, Rashi tells us we need to remember. So there are many lessons that we can learn from this very inspirational book. But I think three takeaways that I hope that we were able to meditate on a little bit this morning has to do with the nature of Shabbos and the significance of this special gift that we have of Shabbos, about the dangers of sinas chinam and the care that we have to avoid any type of civil war, any kind of internal conflict, and finally, our confidence, not just the belief in Eretz Yisrael, but in the confidence of our relationship and the permanency of our commitment to, and Hashem's commitment to, for us, our land, the land of Israel. Thank you all for coming. Have a great day. Excellent.